Good. Thank you for your welcome. Thank you for your welcome prayer and blessing. Thank you, Liz, for your introduction. This talk will be in English. And thank you for the generosity of time that you've given me. You give me 60 minutes to talk. Yesterday, Father Larry and I were at a conference, and there was a guest speaker who spoke for 19 minutes without stopping. Now, I look at things in terms of the length of a homily in a Catholic Mass, and really, you stop after 10 minutes if you really don't want people running out the doors. So as I was sitting there, that I realized, I did a quick calculation, that this gentleman had given us 9 homilies, and that I had slept through 3 of them. So this morning you'll have 6 homilies, and if you sleep through 1 or 2 of them, I won't feel bad at all. Thank you very much. I noticed from listening to some of the recordings of past talks that you start out with prayer and song, so I thought I would start out with something from Francis of Assisi himself, which is both a prayer, which is subsequently made into a song. Some of you may have sheets, and if you don't have one, just share one with the person around you or next to you. Is there anybody, a whole section of people sorely lacking in access to sheets? I have 3 of them. They're free, gratis, and for nothing. Can you just take those and share? Thank you. This prayer is from... Is that better, Father Larry? Is that better?
Yeah.
All right. Good. If it falls down again, tell me again, okay? Because I can't see under my nose. Okay. The words for this prayer and this song are from Francis himself. He wrote them as a 23-year-old young man. Why don't we say the words first, and then we're home free after that. And then I'll try to sing a little bit, and we'll do it line by line. So we have a sense of a contemporary setting that helps to move things, because Francis didn't just say his poems or say his prayers. He burst out the fullness of his whole being. Together, let's say, Most High and Glorious God, enlighten the darkness of my heart. Give me right faith, certain hope, and perfect charity. Oh, give me insight and wisdom, that I might always discern your holy and true will. Now, there's a contemporary setting from John Michael Talbot that goes something like this, and I'll do a line, and you can follow me, okay? Most High and Glorious God,
Most High and Glorious God,
enlighten the darkness of my heart. Give me right faith, certain hope, and perfect charity. Give me right faith, certain hope, and perfect charity. Oh, give me insight and wisdom. That I might always discern your holy and true will.
Your holy and true will.
Any brave souls want to try it out with me? Most High and Glorious God, enlighten the darkness of my heart. Give me right faith, certain hope, and perfect charity. Oh, give me insight and wisdom, that I might always discern your holy and true will. You're incredible. You're hired. You're the choir. Thank you for that. These are the words and prayers and longings of a 23-year-old man who, in the words of Richard Rohr, had been pulled, attracted, and seduced by God. He was pushed and pulled right into God's presence and love, and into the hearts of people of goodwill throughout the world for more than 800 years now. Most high and glorious God, enlighten the darkness of my heart. Give me right faith, certain hope, and perfect charity. Give me insight and wisdom that I might always discern your holy and true will. The prayers and longings of a completely sincere young man, the prayers and longings of every completely sincere and young soul. The longing, the praise, and the aspirations of Francis himself provide a wonderful segue into my talk with you this morning. Francis prays and reveals, after all, what you and I long for most deeply in our hearts, and what our brother, Richard Rohr, has sought so intently, and I think you will agree, so intensely, to explore: wisdom. With much ripe and delicious fruit for us to savor and to share. I was asked to come today to speak about his book, Eager to Love, The Alternative Way of St. Francis of Assisi. Well, that's not true. Actually, I was invited to address one particular aspect of this book, the appendix. Well, to be more specific, the third and very last appendix, as well as the afterword. When I was invited to speak to you today, I immediately jumped at the chance. I've heard about the wonderful things that you do and are in our community, and I was and am delighted and honored to be in your midst as your guest and as your brother. And as far as the subject matter of the book was concerned, I hadn't even read it yet. But I jumped at the opportunity anyhow, because the truth is, no one in my whole entire life has ever asked me to talk about an appendix before. Neither my own appendix, which I still have, or anybody else's. And I was given the possibility of spending one whole hour discussing just one of Richard Rohr's appendices. And that possibility seemed intriguing and delightful and exciting for me. An appendix, after all, in terms of the human body, is that tube-shaped sac attached to and opening into the lower end of the large intestine. So when you talk about appendix, you know where things are coming from, and you have a pretty good idea of what they're headed towards. But you know, an appendix is largely an evolutionary throwback. It doesn't really serve an absolutely necessary function in our bodies. It's largely unimportant and ignored until or unless it happens to burst. And at that moment, the appendix becomes very important indeed, and is never, ever ignored. In like manner, the appendix of a book, an edition, a supplement, a codex, sometimes even an afterthought, is almost like, oh, and while you're at the store, could you pick me up a jar of pickles? Or, while I'm thinking about it, before I forget, remind me that we need to talk about the car. A little dent happened to it. That's an appendix. That said, the appendices of Richard Rohr's book are anything but inconsequential or ultimately dispensable or disposable remarks or afterthoughts. Each one, in and of itself, becomes the source of new thought, fertile imaginings, and fresh possibilities. And that, we know, at the end of a very demanding read, can be both exciting and at the same time totally exhausting. But let's talk about it anyhow. Well, heck, let's talk about Appendix 3 and the afterword. We have time. When I read the afterword of this book, I thought to myself, well, why couldn't this be the foreword? Why couldn't this be the introduction to what he's about to teach us and the journey in which he's willing to take us? Because maybe, just maybe, if we read and reflect on these last paragraphs first, it will help us to see the whole landscape, the moonscape, the heavenscape that Rohr has mapped out for us in such fresh, new, and engaging, and I will say very difficult ways. Would you agree with that? It's a demanding read. So, let's go for it. So, what are we waiting for? That's what Richard Rohr, quoting Pope Francis, who challenges each and all of us with living the joy of the gospel. With living the joy of the gospel. And indeed, what are we waiting for? Or in Rohr's terms, what are we eager for? The answer, of course, is that we are, or need to be, eager for love. And eager to love. And eager to be loved. Our willingness or unwillingness to engage in this sacred quest eagerly is the difference for us here and now between our personal heaven and our personal hells in this life and the next one. It is a daunting quest. It is a compelling quest, an overwhelming one. But the terrain has already been laid out for us. The original and abiding pathway is for Christian people of all stripes. And let's face it, no matter what variety we belong to, we all share about 99% of the same spiritual DNA. That pathway is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Many people have walked this pathway before us, and they continue to walk it alongside us today. But two people in particular walked it so specifically and so specially and so marvelously and so marvelously well that we still can't get over it. They are Francis of Assisi and Claire of Assisi. And let's be quite certain here. I think Sister Susan mentioned it in her own talk. They both get top billing. Francis gets the brand. He gets the name recognition. But Claire kept both her sisters and her friar brothers going on in many of their trials for nearly 24 years after the death of Francis. And she really was his spiritual director. They both together are among the stars of the world of saints. They are our celestial celebrities, as if it mattered one whit to either of them. They could care less. But their example, their courage and their faith, their eagerness to love and to look for love and to share love continue to burn bright, and they inspire and they animate us. Both whispering and shouting through the example of their lives, they tell us and they tell our souls, it can be done. It can be done. The gospel can be lived. And you and I can live it. It is possible, and we can learn to live it well. We can learn to live it as well in our lives as anybody else can live it in their lives, including Francis and Claire themselves. Richard Rohr calls the imprint of this particular pathway Franciscan spirituality. It originates and it roots in the experiences of two human beings who lived more than 800 years ago. A man and a woman living in Italy who were Christians in the Western or Roman Catholic tradition who had one simple desire in their lives. Just one. Nothing else. And that was to follow in the footsteps of Jesus Christ, literally, fully, and completely. They were very eager for love, and they were eager to love, and eager to share the love that they received. The man, Francis, our brother, a man whose modesty and humility were seldom articulated his dream and desire, but whose life experiences, whose story and his stories blazed a magnificent trail for us not to admire, but to dare to follow in our own way. Rohr describes this pathway of Franciscan spirituality as one, in his own words, of universal accessibility, a pathway of invitation, and a pathway of inclusivity. Universal accessibility, invitation, and inclusivity. His insistence on these values in his life explained part of his charisma, his charism today, its attraction to people right here and right now. Rohr says that Francis surpassed the boundaries of religion, of culture, of gender, of ethnicity, of era, that is to say, of historical time, social class, or any other measure of worthiness or education. What an invitation. No wonder it's still so appealing today. This is, as we prayed and sang at the very beginning, the pathway of wisdom, to be sure. But it's a very particular kind of wisdom in the Franciscan universe. It is the wisdom of fools. It is the wisdom of intentional naivete. It is second birth wisdom. It is the wisdom of the converted. It is the wisdom of the found who continue to seek. And is the wisdom of the oracles that Rohr challenges us to consult, both in and outside of our churches. And he mentions them very specifically in his reprise. He calls us to revisit, or to visit as if the first time, Scripture, whatever our Scripture is, liturgy, prayer, service. That's within our particular universe of spirituality. Scripture, liturgy, prayer, and service. And then he challenges us to look beyond our individual spaces into the wider realms of poetry and literature and the arts and mythology, and to do so with great openness and a great sense of freedom and a great sense of risk as well. Altogether, nothing excluded and nothing ignored. The entire gamut of human experience which feeds our souls. So we continue our journey backward from the afterword to good old Appendix 3. Ingenuously and most deceptively entitled by Rohr, How Are Things Caused? Have you ever engaged a very bright and very precocious 4-year-old in a dialogue? If you haven't, be prepared. They are relentless in their quest. And they seem to know only one word. And the word is why. Oh, you're nodding your heads. You've had that experience. But mom, but dad, but grandpa, but grandma, why? Why are there wars? Why are there poor people? Why can't men have babies? Why is the sky blue? Why do I have to go to school? And no matter how patiently, lovingly, and in your own best lights, completely, you try to answer, your reply will only and always be met by the same maddening rejoinder. But why? We're in the same riff here, and the same litany with Richard Rohr. Only the question is not why right now. The question is how. Specifically and directly. If you can't explain to me why things don't stay the same, then at least be able and prepared to explain to me how things change. Now, I'm going to enter into dangerous waters here. I don't have a background in philosophy, but Richard Rohr does. So in order to explain what I think he's saying, I've had to try to do a lot of studying to think I understand what I think he's saying. Can you follow me? And thank you for indulging me. And those of you who are philosophers, I welcome you to correct me. Anyhow, this howness of things, this how things change, goes by the philosophical category of causality. I find that very scary. We know it by the less dangerous shibboleth of cause and effect. Every cause produces an effect. That's a no-brainer, right? Right. Don't kid yourself. Rohr takes us on an excursion. And he begins, innocently enough, taking us back to his own first undergraduate class in philosophy in the year 1961. Now, he doesn't mention by name, but he infers the person he's talking about. It is Aristotle. Okay, and he explains to us that Aristotle came up with four specific possibilities when confronted with the question, how do things change? What causes them to change? These are questions about causality. And so Rohr really repeats for us Aristotle's discoveries and definitions. There is formal causality. That answers the question, what is it that makes this what it is and not something else? What is it that makes this what it is and not something else? Aristotle would say, this is a statue. This is a statue of Apollo and not anything else. That's formal causality. Then Rohr goes on to talk to us about something called material causality. And that answers the question, what is this made of? What is its material? Aristotle would answer, this is made of marble. This is a statue. It is a statue of Apollo, and it is made of the material marble. So far, so good? I only got two to go. Then there is efficient causality. By whom or what is it made? Who or what is the primary source of the change? This is a statue. It is a statue of Apollo. It is a statue of Apollo made of marble. It is made efficiently by a sculptor. It is made by Phidias. The efficient causality answers the question, who made it? Who is the author of this? And then, finally, for Aristotle at least, there is final causality. What is its purpose? What is it made for? This is a statue. It is a statue of Apollo. It is of marble. It is made by a sculptor whose name is Phidias, and it is made for as a decoration for the temple. Formal causality, material causality, efficient causality, and final causality. Form, composition, authorship, and purpose. You know, we could stop right here and go to lunch. But that's not good enough for Richard Rohr, and it's not good enough for the next person he introduces to us, and that is Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas has a bug, a bee in his bonnet, about Aristotle. He looks at the four causalities of Aristotle, and he says, something is missing. He said, Aristotle's explanations of change or causality are just fine if you think about complex existence. In other words, if you think about everything that exists as having both form and substance. But Thomas Aquinas believes, and he believes it could be true rationally, that there are angels. And Aristotle doesn't cover the existence of angels. So Thomas will jump in and introduce a new form of causality which covers angels. It's an existence which has form but no substance. And that's what he calls exemplary causality. A fifth form. I don't know what Aristotle's doing about it. He's twirling around the universe about it. But that's stuck with us since then. And Richard Rohr picks up on it. Exemplary or exemplary causality says to us that someone or some event or some object just being what it is causes other things to happen. It's an example. Angels, if they didn't do anything else but just existed, would have an effect on us just by the example of their existence, by being a source of exemplary or exemplary causality. We can figure it out for ourselves. Think about it, people we've loved and lost in our lives. And what we like most about them is just that they were. We can talk about their quirks. We can talk about their personality traits. But there's one indescribable element about them that we can't really describe about them, and that's the example of who they are. Just by being who they are in our lives, they have made our lives different. They've been examples to us. So Rohr is making a leap from Aristotle to Aquinas to us. And he's looking at the figure of Francis, and by implication, the figure of Claire as well. And he is saying they are exemplary or exemplary figures in history. And so for us, here and now, regardless of who we are as human beings, they're affecting us and they're affecting our time and they've affected the course of history. They are important to us as models, as types, and as figures, just by virtue of being who they are. And they have a profound effect on how things develop and change in our world. In other words, someone who is an exemplary cause has a tremendous exemplary effect. An exemplar or exemplar offers us a blueprint, a goal, a vision, and even a sneak preview of our destiny. And in Rohr's words, they, by being who they are, they pull us forward by allurement and attraction. Exemplars as people take their place alongside symbols and archetypes and memories. They all serve or can serve, as he calls it elsewhere in his book, you've heard this expression, primary attractors, exemplars. They bring us upward, forward, inward, and outward. And they manifest profoundly for us as Christians in our experience as God's eagerness to love us. They exemplify through their lives and just their being God's eagerness to love us. Rohr goes on, and this is just the appendix. He says, many of us get stuck in our own safe and simple places. The way I can understand it for myself is looking at the example of a terrarium. We know what a terrarium is. It's a very small, self-contained little universe, and everything is miniaturized. A little space with little creatures and little plants and a little bit of water, and it's its own universe. He tells us that each one of us has lives in our own personal terrarium, but he calls it our imaginarium. And he says it's different for each one of us. Like an American will have a slightly different imaginarium from someone from South Africa, and a Lutheran will have a slightly different imaginarium from an Episcopalian. You get the idea. We live and dwell and walk in this comfortable space of our own personal terrarium, imaginarium. rather than stretch out to new possibilities in life. And whether we know it or not, and most especially if we're very comfortable with our space, we're stuck. We're stuck in terms of having and giving to ourselves a limited set of possibilities, a limited set of ways to explore our world, to explore our souls, our lives, our spiritual lives, and our relationships. A limited way to explain and explore causality, why and how things happen. We then begin to explain everything to ourselves in terms of a very restricted lexicon. And he talks throughout his book in terms of the limitations in which religion turns into ideology for its own sake. And then we get stuck into realms of dogma and doctrine, and we can't wiggle our way out of it. And what is our grace? What is it that returns us to our original source, which is that eagerness for love, the eagerness to receive love, the eagerness to contain love, and the eagerness to share love? He warns us, and I think it's a very valid warning in my own life, that so much of the constriction, the sterility, the oppression, the boredom, the frustration, despair that people experience in a spiritually limited imaginarium or terrarium are so lethal to our lives, our spiritual lives, because everything there is reduced to simple causality, cause and effect, in terms of our own personal vocabulary and lexicon. This then, in its most extreme manifestation, is shown in the fundamentalist knee-jerk response. If there's a question, there must be a good and solid answer. Everything in this world is black and white. It's the Pharisaical response. Are you sick? What did you do to yourself? Are you poor? Why are you so lazy? In time of famine, war, and disaster, what sin did you commit? What did you do wrong? He's absolutely impassioned about this. And he's insistent that in his belief that our exemplars, whether Francis of Assisi or Pope Francis, whether Nelson Mandela or Mahatma Gandhi or Mother Teresa or Dorothy Day, they give us a way up and a way out of this dead end and deadening pathway. It is not the pathway of Jesus Christ. I'm going to insert my own personal concern here, which he has not covered or explored. And I'm kind of curious why he hasn't done so. He talks about exemplars of people of light, and Francis as being a prime model, archetype, an example of that. But we know from our own experience from history, there are also dark exemplars. Stalin, Hitler, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Idi Amin. And they manifest some of those very same tremendously appealing and charismatic aspects of people. So there is a fundamental difference between light and dark that gets obscured in an increasingly relativistic universe. And we need always to be aware of that and watchful for that, because our deepest roots of moral understanding are our gyroscope, our orienteering device, and they are the source of our discernment between light and dark. Rohr insists, that the exemplars of light hold out for meaning instead of for mere answers. And the search for meaning engages us so that having finished this very important book, we also have to continue in our own individual very important struggles. He says to us, exemplars of light like Francis and Claire possess expansive energies of love. So that's one way we can tell the light from the darkness. They possess expansive energies of love. And the people who are eager to love have an effect on us. They change us at a deeper level. And they alone seek to open the field of both mind and heart, he says, at the same time. They move us, again by attraction and allurement, into a different state. where we find ourselves open to directions and possibilities we never would allow or imagine ourselves to contemplate before in our lives. Francis, Claire of Assisi, exemplars of light. I was asked in consequence of this to say a few words in terms of our understanding of what Rohr has been offering us, if we can look for a Franciscan revolution in our own time. You know, the Copernican revolution, the Newtonian revolution, and why not a Franciscan revolution? Well, hasn't it been going on all the time? Isn't that the journey of faith for us as Christian people? Isn't there all of this what we call Franciscan revolution simply contained within the mystery and the constant process of renewal? Not the circle, but the spiral of our faith through our own lives and through the lives we experience through history, in spite of the dark allurements we experience, in spite of the darkness of violence and death and destruction in our lives and our world. But there's emerged on our scene another Francis, Francis of Rome, Pope Francis. And as recently as this Sunday, he posed the question. He said, people ask me, are we in an era of change? He said, no, we are in a change of eras. So the question is, according to his lights, are we entering into, or are we participating in a Franciscan revolution? For Roman Catholics and for other Christians, inspired by internal reforms through the Vatican Council, increasing ecumenical dialogue, prayer, and common working, spread for internally among Franciscan people, men and women and young people throughout the world, lay leaders and members of the Franciscan family, the viability of the contemplative life and lifestyle of the 20,000 poor Claire nuns throughout the world, the vibrancy of this movement possess, I think, a certain enduring witness that continues to find itself anew by finding its roots. Some people say 80 to 90% of what we know about Francis and Claire of Assisi, we've just learned in the last 50 years by doing our homework, by looking to our roots. So yes, the force of revolution has its sources in evolution and in our history and our discovery of who we are. Pope Francis, by conscious and conscientious choice of his name, perhaps is trying to tell us that through this era of his ministry to the world, to all people of goodwill, he's recalling to us Francis and Claire of Assisi as exemplars of light, but most especially calling us to come to our deepest roots, our deepest eagerness for love in following the footsteps of Jesus. His choice of name, his symbols, his symbolic actions certainly exemplify it. But you know, he's 78 years old. Okay? What do I pray for Pope Francis? I pray for him for a very long life. And I pray that he will have the choice and the chance to make very many appointments in the Catholic Church. Because one person is a meteor across the skylight. But many people create an extraordinary change, a change of cosmic proportions. It's wonderful to be inspired by Pope Francis, by Saint Francis, but our source is in Jesus Christ, who lives now and forever. It's our constant abiding source of inspiration, imagination, and guides us and is with us always. I have to say that as a Christian who stumbles his own wobbly way on this pathway of darkness and light. Francis wrote a prayer and a song at the beginning of his life, and he basically was asking God to help him as an individual to find his path and his pathway. And he prayed and sang and worked and struggled in lots of terrible mistakes in so many ways to find God. But the culminating prayer and hymn of his life is another song. It's called, in Italian, it's called Laudato Si. Pope Francis stole it for the title of his letter, his encyclical on the environment. But we know it as the Canticle of Creation. And that's what you have on the bottom of those little pages. And we're all going to learn this, and I'm going to do, Larry, you want to come up with me and Sister You want to come up with me too, Susan? We could sing the verses in Spanish because they have so much passion. But it's just one word, so you know already. Can we say Laudato si? Praise be to you. And the song goes, Laudato si, O mi Signore, Laudato si, O mi Signore, Laudato si, O mi Signore, Laudato si. Oh, mi Signore. That's great. Let's do it one more time. You're still on this side. So I can watch you. Laudato si. Oh, mi Signore. 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 That's good, but there's not a lot of passion there. We're going to clap it, because if you don't like to sing, you can clap. Laudato si. Oh, mi Signore. Laudato si. Stand up. Oh, mi Signore. Laudato si. Oh, mi Signore. Laudato si. Oh, mi Signore, y por todas tus criaturas, por el sol y por la luna, por el viento, las estrellas, por el agua, por el fuego, laudato si. Oh, mi Señor, louder, laudato si, louder, oh, mi Signore, laudato si. Oh, mi Signore, laudato si. Oh, mi Signore, por la mano madre tierra que alimente y sostiene, por las hierbas y las flores, por los montes y las mares, laudato si. Oh, mi Signore, 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 que sentido de la vida sea cantarte y alabarte, y porque está nuestra vida sea siempre una canción, laudato si. Oh, mi Señor, louder, laudato si, your heart, oh, mi Señore, laudato si, I won't tell anybody, mi Señore, laudato si, oh, mi Señor, one more time, laudato si, oh, mi Señore, laudato si, Señore, laudato si, oh, mi Señore, laudato si. Oh, mi Signore, laudato si. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, we're now adjourning for refreshments, and any questions that you want to pose to Father Charles, there's some sheets up here. You can put your questions in the box. We'll have discussion after refreshments.